I ran across this article. I am not a supplier. This is talking about the discussion of the software supply chain and from the perspective of both the user of these packages and also the maintainers. Welcome to Test and Code. If you've found value in this podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go over to pythontest.com and look either in the top menu bar or in the bottom footer? And there's a few links we're going to talk about. Contact is how you can get a hold of me. Newsletter is how I can get a hold of you. And support is how you can find links to things like my book, the PyTest book, PyTest courses, the community where you can ask questions. And that's about it, really. I'd really appreciate if, especially if you could sign up for the newsletter. I'm trying to collect emails of people that might be interested in similar topics. Today on Test and Code, I am thrilled to have Thomas DePierre. Did I say that right? No, I didn't. I did. I said Thomas. It's Thomas?
Thomas is, okay. Is usually the French pronunciation, yeah.
Okay, so I'm practicing a little bit of French pronunciation. So I asked Thomas to be on the show because of an article that he wrote called I'm Not a Supplier. But before we jump into that, can you tell me a little bit about who you are?
Yeah, sure. So right now, Thomas DePierre, right now I work as an SRE at Indeed. So for people that may not know, this is mostly an ops-oriented kind of roles where I work in incident management. So helping people at Indeed, on engineers and ops people, and all be better equipped and supported during incidents. Before that, I have been software engineers for years, working at all kind of levels, mostly trying to unlock people to, you know, get their work done better in a team. So you will find me unlocking build pipeline, you know, CI/CD. You would find me writing small tools for deployments. You would find me debugging something that end up being, that start as the NPM problem to do on the package and end up being a jlibc bug that I would have to fix. So I've done a few years of that kind of things. And so I have a relatively wide range of experience in that. And before that, I was an EE. I was an electronic engineer. So I come from a really, you know, started with electronics up to, at some point, some web stuff. I really have a wide range, yeah.
I ran across this article. Let's talk about the article. Yeah. I am not a supplier. This is talking about the discussion of the software supply chain and from the perspective of both the user of the spikes of packages and also the maintainers and stuff. So yeah. Tell me about this article. Can we summarize it a little bit?
Yeah, totally. So the way I went through the article is that, so for people, I start by defining what a really simple and basic definition of supply chain, right? Which is coming from EE and electronics, that's something I've dealt with. And that can be quite a pain, as we have seen last year, if you have followed what have happened around shortages of all kind of components. And so this idea of supply chain is that when you have a factory, you don't only control, you control what you build in the factory, but you now have a vast web and chain of suppliers that provide you the elements you need to run your factory and produce the thingy-ma-bob that you are doing. And that can explode really fast in terms of size, because if you go to just someone that build, let's say, I need screws, right, to close my case. So I go to a screw suppliers and they send me screws. Pretty nice. Now, at some point, they call me back and they're like, right, we have a problem. We are going to be late to sending you your next shipment of screws, because the machines that we use to package them need a particular kind of metal for a particular piece that is essential to it, and we can't get that particular metal, this particular alloy. Okay. So we can't package any screw. And now, you, as someone that is doing a small thingy-ma-bob that is maybe just a small toy or something, you are now stuck without the you cannot produce anymore because someplace in the world a particular alloy has not been produced. And then when you go there, you discover that the steel factory that has this makes this alloy, it's just that one of the particular temperature sensors they use for this particular machine they need to produce this alloy is broken and they can't find it because the supplier of that particular sensor went bust. And now you are 5 level deep and you have a temperature sensor company that is blocking you from producing despite you being a really like a small toy case company. And so that's a reality of the things you have to deal with in a lot of manufacturing. And so that's the supply chain. And this is an idea we have seen. And after that, in article, I continue with the fact that this idea, as this vocabulary of supply chain, came up regularly, right, recently in the software world. In particular, around this idea of software supply chain, we see that partly high since we have seen more talk about it in the Log4Shell situation with Log4j. But even before that, the SolarWinds particular attack was specially centered around also something that was software supply chain. And this idea that when you build your product, right, whatever you deploy, whatever you send to customers, whatever you even if you do a small tool to help developers, right, you use dependencies. And these dependencies are basically kind of the same thing as the suppliers of a factory, right? You need them. You need them to be there and to work well, and you depend on them for quality, right? If the quality of your screws drop, well, the quality of the end product would drop, and now you have problems. Well, you also have a problem here for this, or for security, and all these kind of things. So there have been a lot of discussion around software supply chain, right? How do we ensure, just like nowadays in factories, that we have good relationship with our suppliers, and that what we get from them is the quality and the security and all these utilities that we want from things we also send to customers or use to customers.
Yeah.
And so that has been a vocabulary we have seen a lot. And I talk about this vocabulary and all this incident where it comes from and all these discoveries that people, especially at particular leadership or governmental level, are discovering that, hey, there is a really wide web of dependencies that every piece of software we use depend on.
Yep.
And that can have really wide impact, right? And I think at this point, I use the XKCD, someone lost in Nevada or something, that supports the whole pyramid of dependencies, and that kind of that. And then we get to the crux of the title, which is that software supply chain discussion. I've had a lot of discussion on what do we want from our dependencies. What kind of quality and what kind of expectation we have in terms of can we track, can we follow where the piece of code that updated this version come from? Are we sure it has not been tampered with, right? Can we trust the maintainer, or did they suddenly accept someone new and that they added a crypto miner to it, which happened recently? And so, and the problem with all of this is that this, the way I talk about it, at least, and the way I think right now I have some problems with this discourse, is that this is adding more demands on the maintainers of the dependencies, except there is a fundamental difference between a supply chain and the software supply chain, which is that most of these tools are open source, nearly all of them. There is not a lot of commercial dependencies these days. They are usually open source in a way or another. And the maintainers are not paid. We are not in a relationship, in a business relationship with whoever uses a packet. And even more than that, everywhere there is a language that is in every single open source license, and so is in every single one of these dependencies, which is that the software is provided as is.
Yep.
And that says it all. There is no supply relationship. I put something up, you do whatever you want with it, but that's on you. That's not on me. And that's a fundamental difference in terms of relationship, which is not the relationship you would have with a supplier as a factory. So, and that's why I think the analogy, the reuse of the vocabulary, become really dangerous and impactful for the maintainer. So that's basically what I try to talk about a bit in the post.
Yeah, and one of the things that's even, I think, even missing from the discussion is, I mean, I've heard some of these discussions about like the maintainers of it. And so what happens? I mean, even if I'm looking at, it's the relationship between the user of the package and the writer and maintainers of the package. It's so invisible. It's just maybe the README and maybe the documentation and the API and whatever. But I go out, I need a thing, I find something that works and I try it and it works. And hopefully I've got tests in place to make sure that the way I'm using it is working and it will keep working. Now, what are some of my expectations? My expectations kind of are like if I really am depending on this, that as the language advances, like another version of Python or another version of Erlang or whatever comes out, that the maintainer is going to keep that updated with the new language features, or at the very least, make sure it doesn't break on new versions. And then their dependencies there, and paying attention to security fixes and all this sort of stuff. But the reality could be, this project may have been made by somebody that was taking a coding boot camp and then bailed afterwards and really isn't ever going to maintain it. We don't know that there's like hints you can look at. How many maintainers are there? Is it active? I mean, there's ways to look at like the health of it, but even if a fairly healthy project can go by the wayside, because some open source projects really are run by paid people. There may be a company this is an interesting one too. You don't know. It may have a company's name on it, but that might be that somebody in the company said, I really want to open source this project. Can I? And they're like, yeah, okay, whatever, but put our name on it. So that helps with our promote, like advertising for new software developers and stuff. It helps a company. And then that person gets bored with it or gets fired or retires or whatever. And that company's not going to maintain it just because it has their name on it. So there's a lot of that can happen. So you almost kind of have, as a user of it, you hope it's different, but you have to realize that it might be not much more than copy and paste from Stack Overflow, because that what you had at one point, you may end up having to be the maintainer of that. So.
Yeah. And even without going to this extreme, I think something that we don't talk a lot about is that a lot of maintainers, like I am for my own, the few packages I maintain, the few things I maintain, it's usually, not always, but usually, it's not part of the job.
Right.
Which means they are going to, even if they are really someone that knows what they are doing, right? And they are still involved in it and they want to keep doing it. Right now, my total numbers, like my total time I can give to open source is probably something like 2 hours per month of real time spending code. If you have a problem and need to fix it because you have a deploy in 3 hours, I can't do that. It's going to have to wait until my 2 hours and hopefully it will be prioritized. And so there is a lot of this reality, which is that for a lot of people, there is a really limited amount of effort they can put in it, even if they want to, and even if they're really good at it and still there for it, it's just really, really hard to keep going. The one I have in mind right now, which I think we at some point, I think disappeared a bit in the discussion. You probably have heard of the Log4Shell situation a few months ago. The Log4j maintainers, as far as I know, some of them took time off from the job to be able to work something like 40 to 80 hours a week during this particular month to try to fix it and support people that needed that. This is a lot more than what we should expect from a maintainer, but the reality also is there was a lot of people affected and that could have a huge impact. So what do you do, right?
Yeah.
And so we end up in this situation where we do have right now a lot of product, a lot of things that are used in real life by even life critical situation, right? In hospitals and in financial services, in really important places that depend on a lot of dependencies which are maintained by someone that maybe can spend 2 hours a month on it, and that's it. And so there is really this, yes, there is also, you are going to have to maintain it possibly, and you cannot trust that. But the reality is that that's not the reality of today. The reality of today is that we have published all these things, and there is a really set of people that are trying to maintain this stuff. And they don't have the time, or maybe you are supposed, because you use it, to be able to maintain it, but in practice that's not realistic.
There's some funding things. I mean, we often can talk about funding stuff, but there's, like, let's say I'm working at a company and we're depending on something, and we know we got a corner case and we'd like to have this thing that we're using support this extra feature or this bug get fixed, and we know it's a corner case and maybe nobody else is getting affected by it. So that's kind of an obvious thing of, I can contact some of the core maintainers, try to get a contract together to say, hey, how much would it be to do this? How many hours can we fund you to do this? Because it's important to us. That's like a slam dunk. Like that, hopefully that people will be willing to do this.
Well, there are a few problems here. And I say that because I have been trying, we are in the Erlang community in partnership with the Erlang Ecosystem Foundation. There are a lot of discussion of how we can do this kind of projects or smaller things and all. And you end up in an interesting conundrum because, and I think Nadia Iqbal talked about it in a book on open source and the open source economy. In theory, yes. In practice, first, you end up needing the maintenance, right? It's not something you can, there is a lot of situation where it's really hard to pay someone inside your company to do that kind of patch, because it needs a lot of knowledge of how the library work, of how the internal system work. So you are forced to use a maintenance. The problem is, maintenance usually already have a job.
Yeah.
And so they would love to sell some of their time for this kind of work, but they don't have the time. And if they only, because there is a finite amount of time in the day and you have to work, you have kids, you have family, and so that limits what you can do for open source work.
They also might not be able to contractually. Their job might say they can't accept money from other people.
Right. And so the answer I get is, well, you leave your job and you work from the open source work. And the problem we have is that this kind of bounties, because it's really a bounty for a particular fix, right? It's not stable. If I have a mortgage I have to pay every month, I am not going to live from bounties like that, right? I can't promise I'm going to get them every month or something. So it's not really a solution, right? It helped for some projects, and it has been helpful at the edges. There have been a few things like that. But long-term, this is not really a solution for the amount of maintenance that we need now, right?
Well, and then there's the other part is, I don't have a corner case situation. I have, like, it's like the Log4j thing. There's something obviously broken, even though companies all over the world were depending on it. How do you, I'm like, I don't want to pay for it because everybody should pay for it. And yes, everybody should pay for it. So it's a bummer. I don't know if these people were paid at all when they took time off to fix it, but it wouldn't have cost much if we said, like, really everybody that's using it, pitch in $100 if you're a company, $5 for your person, and that should have been fine. But yeah,
I mean, that's what makes it hard, right? And because you get multiple factors here, but one of them is a company, like, they are not really going to pay you $100 invoice.
Yeah,
it's too low, right? So there is already that, and then you have a second problem, which is how do you organize to collect all of this money and distribute it fairly?
Sure, right.
And then you have the problem of, right, that needs to happen all the time.
Yeah.
And so you get into something that looks a lot, and I'm using a lot of the look like, right? It don't have to be, but it looks a lot like taxes for infrastructure use.
Oh, yeah. I never really thought about that.
Whereas everyone pay a little bit, and there is a central organization that finances the things that everyone use like this. So I use a lot of look like because I know that when I see this word to an open source community, usually people have reactions, but it does look a lot like it, right? And that's really hard to do because on top of that, it can be really hard for organization to cooperate because they can be competitors. And so that creates all kind of legal problems too when you cooperate. That's why we have things like the Apache Foundations or the Linux Foundation. And it's a really hard problem. And also because they may not see the other problem with this kind of thing, which is really maintenance, right? Nadia Iqbal, again, I think I'll link it in the blog post. I link the Road and Bridges report she did in 2016 after the Heartbleed attack. She talked of that as infrastructure. This is infrastructure maintenance. And the problem with infrastructure maintenance is that you cannot easily give a value to what you pay for. What if no one maintains a bridge for 10 years? It's still up, right?
Yeah.
and that's really, really hard to sell to businesses in a lot of ways. And on top of that, all of this maintenance are independent all over the globe, right? You can have people everywhere, and they can have fairly different relationship to the open source.
So it's really, if we had that sort of system in place, it'd be very much more profitable to build flaky software then. Because I get paid to fix it all the time.
Yeah, but the reality is that it's already it's too hard to do not flaky software. It's not like it's, I mean, and I'm not hitting at anyone, right? I write my own software and all. Let's be honest here. It's already hard enough to get something that works sometimes. So I don't think there is so much incentive here in practice.
Yeah. So and now I want to, aside from the money, one of the other things I wanted to bring up is that even with active maintenance. So there's a couple of projects that I maintain, but the reason why I open source them is just because I don't care that they have to be private, and I'd love to have people contribute if they want to, but also it's solving a problem that I have. So a lot of open source projects are solving a problem that the person has. So they wrote the software. They're just sharing it. They just happen to be sharing it. So a bug report comes in and says, you know, or a feature request of like, this would make my life a lot easier if you did this. And I evaluate it and go, actually, I've got some test cases that if I did that, it would slow it down by 30 milliseconds. And I've got some tight loops and I don't want to spend that 30 milliseconds. So yeah, it's not a problem for me and it would slow down me. So no, I'm not going to do it. Whereas like, so the decision of what features should go in, what features should go out are based on my needs, or the needs of my company. And so that's going to be, That's a reality of a lot of open source projects, and that's where the as is thing. I think that that's one of the things that was actually freeing for me to be able to say, no, I just don't want this feature in there because maybe it makes your life easier, but I have to maintain it forever. So no.
Yeah. And also this is where we begin to talk about the fact that when we talk about, well, what we say usually at this moment is, well, if you want the feature, fork it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, fork it and change it. And something I think we are starting to realize, especially at the lowest level, right? All the things that run, that is really our infrastructure, right? I'm thinking of things like glibc, OpenSSL, the language runtime, like C, Python, the tooling around packaging, right? I know there's been a lot of discussion around how you host and pay for the bandwidth of this packaging and how you write the code and maintain it. The standard library of this language. We're talking about Python before. I know there's been a lot of discussion around the fact that the Python standard library has a lot of modules that are not really well maintained anymore because there is no one that can own them and work on them that much.
Yeah.
And so there is a lot of there is a high cognitive cost into just getting up to speed into what to do in a code base like that. And so forking is not really a realistic answer most of the time. And so we end up in this situation where, thanks to the ease of use, it has become used everywhere. And of course, the maintainer control what they want to do for their copy of the code and the one people decide to use, so that's great for them. But forking may not be a solution either. So we get in this really strange conundrum, right? Where we have this, we are stuck in this relatively hard situation where you only have a bad decision. All your decisions are bad.
Yeah, but you know, it's not a new situation. I got a medium-sized nail and all I got is a big hammer and a small hammer. You got to pick.
Yeah, the difference is that now when something goes wrong, it's not just your nail, it's everyone computers that run everything. Right? But that's, I think that's a realization we're beginning to get in, right? It's the reason we see that much demand, right, that we see that it has grown, is also because we, and there is multiple factors here over the last decade, approximately, I think, I would say that it really has an explosion of the use of open source at every level. And that's great. But it also means now that there is a lot of things that depend on that, on this particular set of software that are maintained by a few people in their free time, yeah, with the needs they have and the limitations they have. And that creates this kind of really hard discussions around, well, software supply chain. And also, how do I even, something we have not talked about yet, but something that happened that people have really realized, especially with Log4j, is that how do we know we even run it? Because it became so permeated, open source dependency have become so much part of everything we do that it's really, really hard to even know you have them.
Oh, yeah. So taking back to the supply chain analogy, if I'm just buying some screws from some company, I'm not using the thermistor at the factory halfway around the world. So I'm not using it. Software is different. My dependencies, I really am using it. So if I pull in some code, I really am pulling in the code that the other person's pulling in as well. So yeah, that's where it breaks down a little bit. The part where it sort of is similar is build stuff. So like, let's say the project that I'm depending on can't do, their CI/CD is broken because Jenkins is broke. Well, I'm not using Jenkins, but they are. And so whatever, we're running a little long, but I was curious do we have any like solutions to this that we haven't covered, or are there any solutions?
I mean, the software supply chain people, which people that really work in this domain, have done a lot of work on trying to write frameworks around, hey, if you do all these things, it's easier for us to trust what's happening in there. In particular, you can find one framework that has been pushed a lot lately on slsa.dev. I don't remember what the supply, I don't remember what is the whole acronym. But this is something that's been passed around a lot lately. I think it's mostly, but not only, a project pushed by Google. Like a lot of things on the .dev, but not everything on the .dev TLD. There have been also a lot of work on outside of that on the BOM, so software bill of materials, in particular following an executive order by the Biden administration following Log4j. And so a lot of this, the Log4j shell situation, and so a lot of this have been coalescing around the past few years. There are a few commercial projects around trying to collect the data of which dependency you use and making you pay a subscription that they will redistribute to the maintainers of the dependencies. There have been a lot of foundations that have been propping up, especially in the language-specific ecosystem, right? Like I think Python Foundation exists. There is an Haskell Foundation. There is a Erlang Ecosystem Foundation now. You can keep going in all this language where you see that they have been propping us these past few years to try to get money from sponsors from people that use, that are from companies that use the community, and to try to finance a lot of the basic infrastructural work of this community, like the package manager, which is usually, which has been historically really hard to finance. There has been also a few stuff coming from governments. The German government just set up a really small, comparatively sovereign fund, kind of, quote-quote, to invest into fundamental infrastructural project, something like OpenBGP Daemon, right? Something we don't think a lot, but the BGP implementation that nearly everyone uses is kind of open source. And if that one go bad, if you have worked at the low level of the internet, you know that if BGP go bad, everyone has a bad time. And so yeah, that's the kind of thing that makes sense to found. So there have been a lot of initiatives, and that's great. Will any of them have mass, have sizable impact is still a quite an open question. The reality is that most maintainers are not funded. There is not enough money at all to fund them in a stable way. But we are seeing some progress in some aspect.
I almost think that, I don't know, it, a solution, this isn't a solution, but like my brain jumps to, why does somebody else decide how much I get to maintain something? So that's not how, if I sell a part, I get to decide how much it costs. So, so I mean, we could say that my software is free, but, and we have seen this in different parts of software. My software is free, except for if you're a company, you have to pay a piece, you have to pay a little bit. Now the problem is with the dependencies. So the, if my software is being used by another open source project, they're open, so they're free, so they're not paying me. But if they have the same license, they're getting a little bit from somebody. Who are they passing it along? Don't know.
Well, a part of the problem here also is that, and there is a lot of discussion in the community, but this is not open source anymore for some of the really big definition of open source. And so at this point, you are back to selling commercial software, which is great, but create all kind of discussions around, well, now can people provide patches? Because now you make money from their work.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, and and things get really complicated, and you license that work, so you have to get to, you need to get copyright assignment, which is a whole discussion that happened a lot. Like, things become really complicated. We're not really structured for that, right?
Well, there's also, even the solution of, like, we know that companies are distributing some money to some projects. Well, those projects are suddenly, there's a little different feel around them. And I don't know if I want to do a bug fix for it, because that's, I'm doing free work for a project that is going to benefit with money, sort of thing.
And yeah, and we came to the discussion of fairness, right? Fairness of access, fairness of results, and all kind of things. And this is kind of where I think we, the comparison to infrastructure kind of reappears.
Yeah.
Right? Is who get to access, who get to decide, who get the money, who get to decide where do we invest the money, and who get access to that, are really hard question. And so the reality is that we can't avoid answering this question at this point. That may take a long time, that may be really painful, but the reality is that we now underpin a lot of what makes the world run for a lot of people. And so, like, if the software ecosystem of a hospital go down, that's kind of bad. Do we say that hospital can only run commercial software then? That's probably not what we want. So we get into this hard discussion, right?
Yeah, or the bridge analogy is an interesting one, because the person that built the bridge originally got paid for it. But in software, we kind of want to pay for people to fix things, but we don't necessarily want to pay for them to get built in the first place.
Well, that's also, I mean, that's interesting, because that's the opposite for commercial software, where we usually pay people to build it as if it was research and development, right? And said that will be amortized. And then we don't really want to pay for maintenance anymore.
Yeah.
And that has created a lot of problems too, right? We know if you work a lot in software projects that maintenance can be a lot of work for a software project, and you cannot really just build it once and run it all the time. Okay. So maybe a software, and sometimes also, especially in the modern era, now that we have a lot of open source and tooling around languages, building a new piece of software, even if it's really rough at the edges and limited, is not always a lot of work. Right? It may be a lot of knowledge and skills you need to apply, but in terms of pure work, creating a new thing may not be that much. Then you get the litany of edge case and special situation, and that's where a lot of the costs come in, because you need to handle all of that. And now you need to change everything and think deeply about the problem, and that's why you have all this situation. But that looks a lot more like maintenance in a way.
Right. So, it is like maintenance, but also the person that wrote it in the first place shouldn't get nothing.
But that's the kind of discussion of hard discussion we're going to have. And
interesting. Well, so we're not going to fix it all today, but I really enjoyed the conversation. If you've got other parts of this aspect that you want to jump in, get a hold of me. Maybe we can talk about it. So thanks a lot, Thomas.
Thanks a lot.
Toma.
Have a good day.
And we'll talk later. Thank you for listening to Test and Code. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact to reach out to me, or /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, get a course or something. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.